I think so. I mean, the quality in the players we have, like I said, most of them are around 20, 21, 19. So if we can keep that core at the club and playing in the way we do, I think we'll push up further next season in the table and really challenge at the top end.
It's fun stuff, man. It's fun. It's fun to work with kids that are talented around that age. But hey, everybody, welcome back. You just heard David and I talking real quick about the team that he coaches over there in Sweden's Division One, EF Sylvia, and season's coming to a close, and you guys are sitting about mid-table with a really young team. So I guess that's good news, right? I mean, I don't know. You guys probably weren't pushing for promotion, and also probably higher expectations than just staying in the league. So congratulations. It's a good outcome for the season, I would say. What do you think?
Yeah, like we've done well. As we've spoken about it before, like we play really well, we think, and we've struggled a bit in terms of getting enough goals out of our performances and also conceding goals. So we feel like quite cheap. I guess all coaches think that the goals they concede are quite cheap, but we feel like we have fewer points than we should have in terms of what our performances merit. But finishing, like we're ninth now, we're going to finish eighth or ninth in a 16-team league with a very young team we have, and playing the way we do, which is all about developing these players and helping them push on to get higher and further in their careers. That's got to be considered to be a decent season. I think we could have finished higher, but the most important thing is that we keep playing the way we do and keep developing these players. And if we, as long as we stay in the league, that's a success in itself. And then we'll try and push up further when we go into next season, and hopefully stay in the race to challenge for promotion a bit longer, even though that's not the be all and end all of our you know, process really.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you guys are doing well, and it sounds like an interesting project, fun team, and if you're at the helm, I'm sure you guys will be in the league for many years to come and probably eventually in Superettan. So anyway, sounds like you guys overachieved a little bit this year with a young team. And speaking of overachieving, tonight we are talking about none other than Graham Potter, and a little bit on, we'll touch on Brighton and Hove Albion and all the places that he's been in his career. So geez, it's an interesting one, because he was in Sweden while I was there, while you were there, obviously. And so we kind of saw this progression happen from what seemed like the inside, you know, seeing him coach in Sweden and make the jump to back to England and then to see where he is now. It's an interesting case. And I think a lot of people even think that Graham Potter is a future England manager. So it's not a crazy thought at all. And his track record has been really impressive thus far. I think there's been, you know, when big four, big five teams are struggling, there's always these rumors, but I think with him, it'll probably be a reality at some point. So what do you say about Graham Potter? Where do you want to start? Just dive right in.
Yeah, I think we can start at the beginning then, because I think that's one of the most important facets of his coaching is his way of building a relationship with players and his understanding for how he can make them perform at their very best. And I think we can go back to what he did after finishing his career. So he obviously played professionally. He played a few games in the Premier League for Southampton, I think, and he played at a decent level just below the Premier League as well. So he had a good playing career. And then he worked at universities and stuff in England in different places. And I think it was at the University of the Leeds Metropolitan University where he completed a master's degree in leadership and emotional intelligence. And I think that's something that's important and we'll come back to, I think. But that intelligence of knowing how he can motivate his players and how he can get them to perform. And that whole relationship building that seems to be such an integral part of his leadership. So I think that probably goes back to his to his degree, and also to obviously the way he is as a person. But obviously the degree might have helped. But then we look at him coming to Sweden. So he came to Sweden ahead of the 2011 season, and this is interesting for us because the club that you and I both played for, Bodens BK, were in the Swedish Division One at this point, so the third division. And Potter's new team, Östersund, they were in Division Two, so fourth division. And then we kind of swapped places because he got them promoted in his first season. We got relegated. He then got promoted again back up to Sweden's second division, Superettan. And I think they had two or three seasons there before then going to be promoted to Allsvenskan, which is a top division. And that kind of rise in what is like four seasons, they went from Division 2 to Allsvenskan, which is just incredible. That rise is meteor, and I don't know how to describe it better than it's. I don't think any club in Sweden have made that sort of journey that quickly. We had a club called Dalkurd who did something similar, but it took a bit longer to go the final step. But the way he worked with that team, the way they scouted players, and the way they brought good coaches and a good staff to enhance everything they did. So they found players who maybe were, out of favor at different clubs around Sweden, but he got them in, and then he worked with them, and he made them, greater than the sum of the parts. And I think there's been a lot of controversy in Sweden about Östersund because it appeared in the last few years that the chairman had used some illegal methods to bring money into the club. But that doesn't take anything away from the work Potter did, because he still has to coach the players. And I mean, if you give every Division 2 team in Sweden the same kind of funds Östersund have, you wouldn't have all those clubs going on this upwards trajectory to go from Division 2 to Allsvenskan in 4 years, regardless of how much money they had. So you still have to do the work, and he definitely did. So he did absolutely incredible work in Sweden, and that work was topped off by what he did in the Europa League in 2017-18, because Östersund won the Swedish Cup in 2017, and then he got a chance to lead them out into Europe, where they went through a qualifying run to go into the group stages of the Europa League, where they beat like giant clubs such as Galatasaray and PAOK Thessaloniki, which is mental for a club of Östersund's size to go and actually knock Galatasaray out of a European competition. That's incredible and absolutely unheard of. So that again highlights the quality of his coaching here in Sweden. And then they got into the group stages. They finished second in their group behind Athletic Club from Bilbao. And then, like, getting into the last 32, they were drawn against Arsenal. They lost the first leg at home, but then they won at Emirates, which again is an incredible story for a Swedish team in general, but definitely for a team that 7 years earlier were in the Swedish fourth division. So the rise he took Östersund on is incredible, and highlighted his credentials already there. So let's just start there. And you were, as you said, you were here during this time. What did you pick anything in particular up around Potter at this time and at his work in Sweden?
Well, when you said that his degree seemed to play a factor in the style of coaching that he deployed, it's so true because, and what was the name of the degree again? So we can just
remember. I think it was a master's degree in leadership and emotional intelligence.
Right, and so I think he began. I think his platform for success is just knowing players, knowing people, and getting the best out of all of them. And I think that I remember we had a couple English players who had played under him in those lower divisions before they really started to make their way all the way to the top. And or like, for example, we have a teammate, David and I, in Sweden named Robbie Clark, who is still around Sweden, I believe. I remember he would, when Graham Potter would achieve something, I think with Swansea, Robbie would, you know, like write on his Facebook page or comment or something going on social media. And then I remember Graham Potter would comment on it and say, "Thanks, Robbie. I miss you, pal. You know, it's so good to hear from you," or something. And, you know, that's the kind of character that sticks with players, that makes players want to win for you. So it's just, I remember that stuck out to me. And years later, I still remember it. It's like, okay, so this guy must have been one of those managers that you really wanted to play for, that you wanted to fight and win for. So he starts with that. And then on top of that, you know, his brain for football, his hunger to learn and stuff is really evident, because I know he spent a lot of time in Spain and just seems like one of those people that just studies and studies and studies. And his tactics were evidence of that. Like, he would employ a couple different systems within a game, and every player knew exactly what they were doing at all times. And then on top of that, the scouting and everything that was going on at Östersund, I don't know how much of a hand he had in, but they had some fantastic players while he was there. And like you said, they went to the Emirates Stadium and beat Arsenal. And yeah, like, that's just nuts. And especially when you look at, they always had several English players that were not even close to the Premier League, and then would go over to Sweden and he would help them find their feet. And maybe they, you know, maybe they had showed potential at one point and then kind of faded or whatever it was, but he got the best out of these English players that were like, just, you know, unheard of, essentially. And then, yeah, you throw in the likes of a player like Ken Sema, who really like kind of rose to prominence at Östersund, and Saman Godos, who was there for quite a while and is now at Brentford in the Premier League. It's like, what he did in Sweden was really special, and I wasn't that surprised to see that he went back there with a big club like Swansea and did quite well with them there. So yeah, you want to take us through the next part of his career and what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, you obviously alluded to it there, but he went to Swansea in the Championship, and Swansea had just been relegated. And I remember, because I follow a bunch of Swansea fans on Twitter, and I remember from this time that Swansea struggled very much off the pitch, which then led to them struggling on the pitch in terms of seeing their best players leave and struggling to get replacements in. So he had to work a lot with young players that they already had at the club, which he did really well. So someone like Daniel James, for example, who hadn't played, you know, proper first team football for Swansea, really, he was given an opportunity to play and did so well that he earned a move to Manchester United at the end of the season for, I don't know, £15 million or something. So he kept this, like we talked about in Sweden, he developed players that no one else really wanted. It's probably a bit strong, but players that hadn't been given the opportunity to play at the level that he then, you know, provided the platform for them to go and perform from. But at same thing as Swansea, young players coming through, playing very attacking, attractive football, working on his template that really is all about building from the back, creating overloads in midfield and getting players turned in the spaces in front of the opposition's defensive line, so they can, you know, control the game from there and force players to step out, and then that leaves spaces behind and they want to exploit that space with runs from the strikers. So that style of football remained, even though a lot of people probably thought that, okay, Swansea don't have these players anymore that can play the style of football that they've played for a long time. But he got them back to the roots, the Roberto Martinez, Brendan Rodgers, Michael Laudrup style of football, where they're very dominant, they're playing very attractive football, and they finished 10th in the Championship, which, you know, they didn't get to go to the playoffs or anything, but they had a really good season, regardless of the struggles off the pitch and in terms of recruitment and stuff. But probably the thing that saw Potter's, you know, coaching star rise to prominence was when they faced Manchester City in the FA Cup, and they pushed them really close, and they were 2-0 up with, you might remember better, but I think 20 minutes to go, and then City scored three in the last 20 minutes to win and go through. But that again showed, because they didn't go into that game just dropping off and hitting long balls on the counter attack for Dan James to use his pace and run through. They actually tried and played, and they managed to, you know, to really compete with City, despite the difference in class between the two sides, which just again highlights how structured and how, you know, organized and prepared Swansea were for that challenge. And I think that's what led to, at the end of the season, Brighton having decided to move on from Chris Hughton, that led to them contacting Swansea to see if Potter would be interested in moving to the Premier League and coaching them. So and we can just quickly look at his first two seasons at Brighton. He kept them up twice. In his first season, he recorded a record points tally for Brighton, and then he achieved the exact same points total last season. So he's made them better than they were before. They've been fighting relegation in both of his seasons so far, and that's interesting when you look at the underlying numbers, because I think in like last season, 2020-2021. The expected point, so what their performance would have merited if they had scored the goals that they were expected to and not conceded as many as they did, then they would have finished fifth or sixth in terms of performance, but they finished 16th, I think. So that just shows you the gulf in. Like if Brighton had had like maybe a few better finishers, someone who could get them 10 or 15 goals, or maybe two or three of those players, like the top teams have, then Brighton would probably have finished, like they would have challenged for the Champions League. So that shows again how well they were playing and how drilled they are and how well coached they are in a way. But they didn't have those players and they didn't score the goals that you would have expected them to. So instead they had to fight relegation all through the season. And that for me is quite startling, because you sometimes see clubs like Manchester United would be a good example, who have an expected points tally of maybe 60, but then they get 70 points because they have really good players who go and score goals at big moments where other players wouldn't score. And then their performance is kind of saved by the quality of the team. Whereas for Brighton, it was the opposite. So their performances was let down by the quality of the individual players at times. But again, it just shows how well they actually were playing. What do you say about these two first seasons at Brighton? Anything that stood out to you in particular?
Just exactly what you said, man. It's like they didn't have any of those like magic players that, and most teams that are in positions like Brighton don't, but if they did, like, you know, that's what they were looking for when they sign. I mean, maybe not like the X factor player when you bring in a player like Danny Welbeck, but they're certainly trying to bolster their team with more, you know, consistent and known quality. And they do have a couple players that have really proven to be kind of like diamonds in the rough, and who can, I think, for example, I think Leandro Trossard is a brilliant player. I think he could be that player for Brighton this year that pushes to be in the conversation for, like, you know, Premier League team of the season or something like that. So I think maybe this year they've started out, they've drawn more games than they probably deserve to have. I think they could have probably won a couple of those. And if they had, then they'd be sitting right up there in Champions League contention. Still they're level on points with Manchester United at the moment, but I think things are going that way a little bit more for them this year. They sold Ben White in the offseason for a ton of money, and Cucurella, who is not exactly a like-for-like replacement because he plays wide, but what a player he is, and I would not be surprised at all if he snuck into the, you know, a Premier League team of the season or had some sort of recognition at the end of the year, because he's been fantastic from, in my opinion. So if they can continue to add to the squad like they do, and then, you know, they it's a fun mix of kind of, you know, English old dogs with their back line of Dan Byrne and Shane Duffy, who I know is Irish, but, you know, and these guys who've been in the league for a long time and been around English football and, you know, are real English football players. But then they have a great goalkeeper in Robert Sanchez. They have some experience in Lallana. I think Joel Veltman brings a lot. They have real quality in another player that they brought from Lille and Bissouma. This Enoch Mwepu, I think, is looking like the real deal. That goal that he scored against Liverpool was out of this world. So this year kind of could be, you know, like you said, we could see what should happen to them if they do have players that can push those games over the line. Like you say, like Ronaldo is just adding points and wins to United when they don't really deserve them.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, Brighton is the same, have been the same example, just without a player that can get them over the line. So maybe this year is that year with the additions they've made. And I mean, you never know. You never know where they could finish, but it's sure fun to watch them right now.
Yeah, and I think, again, like we spoke about developing players and someone like Lallana, who, you know, for me has basically played as a 10 and wide and sometimes in a midfield three as one of the attack and more attacking midfielders for Liverpool and Southampton during his career. He's now playing basically as a single pivot in games, and he's running games from deep. And I mean, he's probably always had that ability to do that, but he's never been trusted to do it up until this point. So again, that's how he works with the players he has, and then he looks at what can this player do, and how can I help him, you know, help the team in a different position that he might not be used to. And Lallana's doing really well from doing just that at this moment. We have you spoke about the defenders like Lewis Dunk, Shane Duffy, Dan Byrne, who are like all playing out on the back with the sort of calmness that you would expect from you know, £80 million centre backs playing at City or Liverpool or Man United, and it's incredible to see how he's made this team so composed in possession. Because if we can compare this style of play now with the style of play under Chris Hughton, it's very much different, because that team under Hughton was quite solid defensively, very 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 well organized, but they were happy to give the ball to the opposition and then look to win it and then counterattack quickly and play a more direct style of football, which, looking at the squad, you can understand. But Potter, he looked at the squad, they made a couple of additions obviously to help him, but then he's changed that style of play by just his coaching. It's basically the same squad between the first season he had and the last season Hughton had, but they made some changes to the way they play and drastically changed the style just by, you know, working on the training pitch and it convincing these players that this is the way they should play, and playing a style as they do, it's obviously going to help, because most players they want to play football because they like to have the ball. That's why they start playing, and getting back to that is obviously something I think most players would like, rather than just sitting off and waiting for something to happen. Another thing, because we're going to move into his tactics now just briefly, and he's using a lot of interesting tactical ideas. And another thing in terms of how he uses players to get the best out of them and also to help the team, I want to take an example from when they played Manchester United away from home in, I think it was last season, and he used, I think it was Pascal Gross and Jakub Moder, the Polish centre midfielder. So they played as wingbacks, both of them, out of possession. So they played as wingbacks, and then in possession, they went inside and played in midfield. So they inverted from wingback positions, and we've seen fullbacks inverting, so that's nothing new, but very few teams use their wingbacks to then come inside and play centrally. But these two players, who are obviously midfield players, both of them, he then used them in a way where they are comfortable and where they bring most to the team, because both of them, Gross and Mulder, if you would play them wide as like proper, you know, wide outlets, that's not their game. But they are central players. So by having them defend wide, but then invert, he could get them into positions and areas where they are more comfortable. But then he had to balance that out. So he then had his two strikers, who I think, I don't remember exactly who played. I think Mope was one of them, who are more comfortable playing wide. So the two strikers, they would move and play wide, and the wingback would come inside. So it's very innovative in the way he moves players around the pitch just to get the best out of them when they have the ball, and then they can defend in different areas based on the principles of the team. But in terms of, like, again, using the players that he has to gain great success in the way they play and adapting everything around the players he has and forcing them to take responsibility in different areas of the pitch, and, you know, allowing them to perform to the best of their ability from areas where they are comfortable, but also challenging them in a way that, you know, placing two midfielders at wingback can be challenging, and it might be difficult for them to straight away agree with that decision. But then when they see why, because they can get an extra advantage of coming inside and they will catch the opposition off guard, they can see the benefits of listening to the coach, and that obviously strengthens his position as well going forward. And in that game, Brighton were unlucky not to leave Old Trafford with a win. So he definitely does interesting things. And before I go into my other tactical points, I just want to check if there's anything you want to add there before I go into some more tactical details.
No, man, dive right in. I just want to say I do love the fact that you've got these old dog center backs like Dan Byrne and Shane Duffy and all these guys, like you said, playing out of the back like they're Virgil, you know, like they are these 80 million pound center backs. So I think that's just great, man. I think that's a perfect indication of who Graham Potter is as a manager, getting the most out of players that you wouldn't expect. And I just love that. So. But keep going, please. This is great.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah, I just wanted to check that because, you know, I can get into the knitting here for hours. But in terms of what, like, you can't say that Graham Potter has a style of play. He's extremely flexible. And that's what makes him, I think, very interesting for top teams in the future. And we'll come back to what the future might hold for him. But I think he's a great tactician in the way that he can adapt his team and the style based on the game and the challenge at hand and going into a new game. Because if we just look at two games, we look at the games against City and Liverpool this season. So the City game, they played virtually a man marking system. So out of possession, they played man v man against City across the pitch, and they did it really well because they pushed City. They really went toe-to-toe with them, and they managed to, like, this sounds weird because City won the game 4-1, but they managed to nullify City in a lot of phases of the game, but City were ruthless on the counter-attack. So Brighton didn't lose the game because they defended poorly. It's just that they didn't defend counter-attacks as well as they could have. And then when City won the ball, you know, with the quality they had, I think it was Grealish, Foden who definitely played and were decisive in big moments in that game. Gundogan scored again as well, I think. But if we take the goals away from it, as weird as it sounds, but if we take the goals away from the game, Brighton did really well in terms of going toe to toe with City, even though City were the better team and deserved to win the game, but it showed that they can challenge these big teams, and as I said, they weren't undone by the tactics of going man v man. They were undone by not maybe reacting quick enough to counterattacks, because City, when they go for it, they're scintillating. It's difficult to stop them for any team, but Brighton struggled with that, to deal with Foden in particular when he dropped off and try to link play and then quickly attack space in behind. And that was the difference on the day, and you might remember that well, I think, because you obviously, you're a City fan, you probably watched the game and seen all the goals, because a 4-1 win is a 4-1 win, but that just showed how he can play man-v-man. And then in possession, he used his goalkeeper as a centre-back, kind of. So the goalkeeper would move out and play as a right-sided centre-back in possession to get an advantage against City's press, because they get an extra player. They get an extra player in the first line, and they get an extra player further up the pitch, because they can push, you know, a fullback higher. So they would split with their three centre-backs, and one would go and play as a normal left centre-back. The goalkeeper would come as a right centre-back, and then they would have the two outer centre-backs as fullbacks, sort of. Which was interesting. Like, City have done that with Ederson at times, but not many teams do. But they did that too, and they managed to play out from the back quite well at times. So very flexible in that game. Then they played Liverpool a few weeks after that, and it was totally different. So from going man v man against City, they were more ball oriented, I would say, against Liverpool, where they kept a solid shape and then looked to press together as a team. So that man marking system was gone, and instead they used a sort of hybrid 4-2-3-1, 4-diamond-2 sort of shape, where they were solid down the middle to stop Liverpool progressing there, and then they looked to steer the ball wide and then press really aggressively and stop Liverpool from dominating the ball. And especially in the second half, this worked really well, and Brighton actually ran the game for a bit. So Liverpool were ahead, but Brighton came back and made it 2-2, which the game finished. And I want to look at the second goal they scored in that game. So you spoke about Mwepu's brilliant first strike, but then the second goal, and this is straight from the training ground. So Liverpool play a very narrow shape when they press. When they defend. So what they want to do is they want to force the ball wide, and when the ball goes wide, they want their fullback to step out and press the ball, and then we'll shuffle across, and then we'll try and win the ball in the wide areas. What Potter obviously knew this, so what they did was they pushed Kukurea really high on the left, but then they had Jakob Mölder, who played like on the left of Brighton's midfield. He would basically stand on Trent Alexander-Arnold, so he would pin him, so he couldn't move out, because if he would move out, then Brighton could have played centrally with Mölder instead. So Brighton have the ball, they switch it wide out to Kukurea, who has plenty of time and space, because Alexander-Arnold can't jump out and press him, so then he can receive the ball, and then when Trent Alexander-Arnold then did go out to press him, he was late doing this, so like Liverpool had to react to this situation quite late. So when he went out, Mölder kept running in behind, which pushed the defense deeper, because Konate had to go with him, Van Dijk was pushed back, and this created space in front of the defense. And then Kukurea played a ball into that space, and Brighton had a 3v2 against the center backs. They combined and scored a great goal, and that's just. It looks simple. So a centre back switches the ball wide to a fullback. He plays it in centrally, and then they found themselves in space and go and score a goal. But it's very detailed. If Mölder doesn't stand on Alexander Arnold, he can go out and press quicker, and Liverpool can avoid conceding that goal. But he didn't, and Mölder did pin him, and then they got that extra space. And if we go back to what we said at the beginning with Östersund about getting players into that space in front of the opposition's defense between the lines, where they can create advantages and superiorities in terms of who steps out to press the ball, does that leave space for someone else, can we get into that space, and so on. And that's exactly what happened with this goal as well. So we see he's still consistent with his style that worked in Sweden. He keeps doing that. He just changes it game to game based on which players he has, and that's just the hallmark for a great tactician. And I think if Brighton, they haven't won in 5 now, they've drawn 4, I think, and lost 1. But if they can get a few more wins, and they can actually, if they get the belief that they can go and really challenge, there's nothing saying that they can challenge for European places this season. And I'm thinking more Europa League, Europa Conference League, those sort of positions, which would be an incredible success. And it would be great to see a team playing this style of football actually, you know, succeeding doing that on a smaller budget and with a lot of very interesting players. And that's what might see him then take the next step, because that's the big question: what's going to happen with Potter going forward? That I think is something we need to look at. So I'm gonna throw that one over to you. What do you see in the future for our man here, Graham Potter?
Well, if he doesn't end up at Tottenham in the next couple of years, then no, it's tough to say, because if he continues to perform like he is, which I assume that he will, because he's that kind of manager who has all the tools, who is just studying incessantly, then it's only a matter of time before he wants a bigger challenge. And I think he would be really well suited for the England manager job. It just depends on what happens with Southgate. That's a tougher one to predict for me, just because I feel like I know less about what England themselves are looking for in a manager than clubs, you know. But I think we will see him in England at either the very top at Manchester United, or at somewhere close to the top, like an Arsenal or a Tottenham or something, someone like that. I don't know, maybe even an Everton, depending on what their future holds. But he'll be somewhere. He'll be somewhere different within, I would have to say, 3 seasons probably. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the difficult thing is that the top teams, they normally recruit from like a group of coaches who, you know, won big prizes, and Potter hasn't done that. And that's, you know, it's not surprising, because he hasn't been at clubs that are in any way expected to win big prizes. I mean, this is his third season in the Premier League, so it would be absolutely unheard of, except for Leicester, I know, to go and win the Premier League with Brighton. But I mean, if you're a club and you see the work he's doing, the work he's been doing for 10 years, like, he hasn't had a failure yet, really, and he, you know, consistently does well with the tools he has. If he could get the best players and play this way, then I think there's no limit on what he could go on and achieve, because he evidently connects with players on an emotional level and builds relationship with them, as you mentioned with our former teammate Robbie Clark. And I think that's a quality that might be overlooked at times, because that's a big thing, especially if you're at the club for over time, that you are able to create these relationships. Because at the end of the day, it's all about relationships in terms of how we get people to perform, how we get them to listen to instructions, how we get them to take information on. It's easier to take information on from someone you like than from someone you dislike. I mean, that's just how people work. So if he has that, and he has a tactical knowledge to play at this level and an even higher level in the Champions League, I would assume he should be an option for anyone. The only question would be how he would handle, you know, superstars, because he hasn't done that. But as I said, I would back him to deal with them in a similar way to how he deals with every other player he has. He's even if you're a superstar, you're still a human being. And if you can take care of the human being behind the player, then I think you can get anyone on board and get anyone to perform. So I wouldn't rule out, like, you'd need to be a clever club. But I could see Potter going to City at some point, because I think his style of play is very, very. It is similar to the way City play, but it's not an obvious match straight away, maybe. But I think he's someone who they should be looking at when Pep eventually moves on, because if he's given time, with all the structures that are in place, with the way they work in terms of recruitment with their academy and stuff, I think he would be an absolutely excellent appointment in a few years when he's continued building at Brighton and continued working and honing his ability in the Premier League. If he continues to do well, why not? Like, I think City are the kind of club with, you know, they have the know-how at the club. They can see through the sort of noise that's sometimes made about managers. Oh, he's this type of manager. He plays defensive. That's not our tradition. He only plays to win for 2 years and then he goes, as we spoke about with Conte before. I think City are smarter than that, and they could probably see the quality of Potter, and then I think he could be someone they'd look at if he continues to do well. And that would be my bet. But the question is, does he need a club in between to go to a super club? Would he have to go to an Everton and then go up? But then I think if he continues to do well at Brighton, there's nothing saying that Brighton couldn't be better than Everton in two years or whatever, and be considered to be not a bigger club, but a better club at that moment in time. So very interesting, but I think the very top is on the horizon for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with everything you said. I think a great parallel to draw right now would be when Sir Alex Ferguson left United and they turned, I don't know who they considered other than David Moyes. It didn't seem like there was any rumors about anybody else. Do you remember differently?
No, it was straight away the chosen one.
It was straight
one.
To Moyes. That's what I thought. It was. I don't remember any other option being discussed, and it seemed like an okay idea in the regard of, you know, David Moyes had overachieved with Everton for years. He'd shown consistency, et cetera, et cetera. But he never really showed that he had like the tactical, you know, like prowess to make top world class players play in a style that he wanted. You know, that was never really part of his resume. And so it would take a club having some balls, for lack of a better term, to hire him and put him in charge of huge names and under, you know, in the biggest stadiums in the world. But the thing that he's exhibited, unlike David Moyes, is that he does have these like incredible tactical ideas, and he can change his style so easily, and he's so confident in the way that he can make players play. So to have, like you said, the humanistic part is massive. A lot of coaches rely just on that, to be honest. I mean, you can get by on that sometimes at lower levels if you can just make players fight like nothing else for you. Then, you know, some coaches skate by on just that. But when you add the, you know, like the really truly tactical like mastery of a different systems to it, then it's like you said, the sky's the limit. So I think you're right that if the timing lines up, I think we could definitely see him at City after Pep. But I think another opportunity might present itself sooner than that. So
yeah,
time will tell, but it'll be interesting to see. And I back him wherever he goes. I think he's got it like that. I think he's that type of manager.
Yeah. Well, it's not possible to end in a better way than tipping him for the absolute top.
Yeah, and I guess we'll have to check back in a couple of years or whenever it is, and do a follow up episode when we actually find out what does happen to him. So anyway, yeah, great talking to you tonight, David. Don't forget, everybody, to check out the blog, runningtheshowblog.wordpress.com, for some great tactics pieces, and of course this pod. So that's all from us tonight. So thanks for listening. We'll see you again real soon. Good night, everybody.